a lot of people, their remedy to the social media issue is by using it less, by counting the time you're on it. And I think it's a helpful band-aid. It's not a cure. The point is to use internet products that don't interrupt your life and your happiness, but instead integrate seamlessly. And by thinking there's an offline, again, that's very destination-based thought that I think we're plagued with, because when we were first introduced to the internet, it was branded as a place to go. And it is not, it is no longer a place. It is just with us everywhere. And so it's time to start building technology that can work within that field.
Diversity of ideas is harder than it looks. Welcome to Innovation for All, conversations on the social impact of innovation with your host, Shayna Ahlquist.
Welcome to the Innovation for All podcast, where it's my job to speak with innovators and technologists on issues of culture, social systems, and diversity. I'm your host, Shayna Ahlquist. In this episode, I spoke with Alex Wolf, an award-winning entrepreneur and technology philosophy consultant. Alex has been using the internet since she was two, which is a little common today, but not so common in the 80s. She started building businesses and e-commerce sites while still in high school. At 21, she dropped out of college to build what would become the fastest growing digital network of female millennial entrepreneurs online, with a following totaling in the millions, which she later sold. Alex writes and speaks about the ways the nature of the internet has changed our social and economic environments and how it's affected us behaviorally. She's been named one of the top 100 most creative people in business by Fast Company magazine. Her personal motto is simple: technology is supposed to make life better. I'm really interested in how technology shapes the ways we interact with each other, and Alex understands this in spades. We discuss how technology is changing human relationships and why texting has become so prolific, even when it's sometimes less efficient than speaking to one another. And while others in the humane technology movement have argued that Snapchat uses some of the most abusive forms of persuasive technology to keep people hooked, i.e. Snapchat, some say is really bad, Alex argues that Snapchat is the digital platform that most closely mimics real-life interactions, i.e., it's the best platform. We also talk about the business models that drive most of our social media systems, the ad-based revenue model, right? When you go on Facebook, when you go on Instagram, when you go on Twitter, you're seeing a lot of ads. What would it look like for established companies to implement alternatives to this model? I was especially interested in her thoughts on podcasting, where content creators like me make and share great content, but earn on the order of $150 for every 10,000 listens. Is there a way forward? Oh, she also argues that technology is a key reason that none of us millennials feel like quote-unquote adults. It's a fascinating perspective, and finally, someone gave me an answer to that question. Lastly, a quick request. I am really proud of this show, and many of our fans say it's one of their very favorite podcasts. I would love to share it with more people who might enjoy it. And that's where you come in. You recommending this show to your friends is the only way we can grow. When you're listening to today's episode, if you're enjoying it or if it raises an issue someone you know might be interested in, I hope you'll pause the episode right then to share it with that person. Send them a text, send them a snap, I guess. Maybe you have a friend who loves Snapchat, or maybe you know someone who feels like they aren't a real adult and wants to understand why. Send them today's episode if you think they'll enjoy it. And without further ado, after that very long intro, please enjoy my conversation with Alex Wolf. Alex Wolf, welcome to the Innovation for All podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are someone who had an early adopter family who maybe became skeptical of technology introduced to you at a pretty young age. Can you walk me through that story?
Yeah, so I have been on the computer since I was two. That's what my dad likes to say, that I've been using a mouse since I was two. And so I honestly don't even have memory of those first moments with the computer because I was that young, which is not a big deal today because obviously babies are playing with iPhones. But, you know, for the 90s, this was not very common. And one of the funny stories that I actually open up my book with is I talk about how in about third grade, when my friends were finally starting to get email addresses, I already had one. And I was so excited to share them with my friends, but my dad had bought a family domain name and all my friends had an AOL.com email address. And so when I actually shared my email address with my friends, they were like laughing at me and making fun of the fact that it wasn't an AOL address. They actually were, they told me like it was wrong. It wasn't going to work. And so I went back home and I told my dad, like, what's up with this? I need an AOL address because I'm getting made fun of. And he was like, why would you want that? It's an advertisement. And I was like 8 or 9 years old. So I don't understand what that even means, but that was sort of the expectation. That's given context to what type of home environment I was as far as the tech literacy and what was the approach and the expectation of how to adopt technology as more of a servant than a master.
Well, I think also the best part of that story is that at any point in time, AOL was the really, really cool domain name. Yeah. It's like my how the tides have turned.
Oh yeah. What he said still stands so correct. And it's something that I obviously makes a bunch of sense now.
I guess let's fast forward to you coming up and sort of becoming a technologist yourself.
Yeah. So needless to say, I had my own computer, and what that meant was I was building my own websites, just playing with things. And I grew up as an only child, so I always say like the computer was my sibling. So I just learned how to do a lot of creative things on the computer that I felt people around me weren't necessarily learning at that time. And I think all of that gave me a head start when I decided I wanted to go into entrepreneurship. And I ended up starting my first company at 21, which was a brand that went viral on Instagram. And again, I think a lot of why that worked was because I had a pulse on the conversation and the expected dialogue and even things like memes and the language that's used to connect with people on that digital landscape was something I felt very comfortable communicating with.
And you ultimately went on to sell that company, correct?
Yes, last year. So since then, I have learned a lot, and the process really illuminated to me so much of what was happening on a social level and what was changing as far as our interactions, our expectations of each other as people, as colleagues, as friends. And it just was so fascinating that I was like, I want to talk about this. I want to talk about how technology is changing relationships specifically and human connection for all generations. But I definitely think I emphasize the millennial generation.
So when you look around among millennials, how do you see technology changing social interactions? And I know that some people might think immediately like, oh, they text instead of call, blah, blah, blah. Right. Is that all there is to it? Or do you think it's more complex than that?
I think it's very complex. I think it's so complex that people who are participating in the language aren't even aware that a new language is forming because it's that inherent and fluent in the way that we have this, you know, grown up with it. And so just to give a more articulate example of what I mean is that technology outdates knowledge by the generation. And so what you had to know as an adult in a previous generation technically is going to be different than the next. And that means economically and socially. And so if you do not keep up with the tech literacy of the modern times, then you can be socially locked out, even economically locked out of how society is, how it's functioning. And so for millennials, it's very important because it's definitely more than just using texting instead of phone calls, because there's all these little internet gestures and nuances that go into that communication to completely neglect other forms of communication and change it to a text-based form is going to change a lot. And it's not necessarily, it's a very crude way of communicating. And I don't think we adopted texting as one of the primary ways to communicate because of just pure, what I call like blind technophilia, which meaning like when we first started texting, it was very expensive. It was very difficult to do. We were doing it on those, number keyboards and with flip phones. And they they weren't designed to be used as primary methods of communication. And the reason why we do it now is because it's cheap and it's easier to text. But what I notice and what a lot of my work is about is why don't we, or how can we start asking questions about what we lose before we start losing those things? And how do we stop just adopting technology just for the sake of it being newer, cheaper, or faster?
So you've identified a lot of, you know, real disadvantages with, let's say, texting. You're losing a lot of context. Historically, it was more challenging. And I think even though it's easier now than it used to be, it's still not as easy as talking, you know? So why do you think texting, for instance, has been so prolific?
I think that a lot of our communication technology has been designed without incorporating or prioritizing the need for the two parties to be present. Meaning that when you're on the phone call, two parties have to be present in order for the conversation to appear, to manifest. And millennials got very spoiled with using communication methods that didn't need that presence. And because of that, I find that many millennials are intimidated by communication methods that the more presence they need, the more intimidating they are. So it starts with like the phone, but then it goes all the way down to human interaction in person. And that, you know, when we're talking about the importance of communication, one of the key factors is presence. And I think that what we're experiencing right now, as far as a lot of the reports coming in about loneliness and anxiety and depression, I think can be easily correlated to the lack of presence I think people are feeling in each other's lives, because we've replaced a lot of what we need fundamentally with technology.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the point you made about it being asynchronous, this idea that I can send an email now or a text message now and that you can respond at your convenience, or that I can respond at my convenience, is a real advantage, right, over sort of interpersonal communication live like this. Like if you ask me a question right now, I can't ignore you. Or if I do, it would be really, really awkward and uncomfortable.
Right.
So I mean, there's also this interesting trade-off with you're losing that presence, as you say, but you're gaining almost more control over the interaction. It feels like maybe that's just really tempting, even though we're giving up something maybe more rich.
Oh, of course. And so that's the thing. That's why I say I talk about tech philosophy, because it's about the approach more than it's about the bits and the ones and the zeros. It's about, okay, what do we want to build this technology for? Are we building it because we're trying to erase the human condition? You know, Henry David Thoreau has a famous quote where he says that all inventions are an improved means to an unimproved end. And the point is that life is going to be difficult and it's going to be complicated, and there's a full spectrum of emotion that you will have to feel to be alive that I think we keep trying to obliterate through the use of technology. And so, yes, we do get to gain this illusion of having more control, but ultimately, we can never outwit our own humanity.
Ooh, but the temptation is so high. You know, we talked about
control. Keep trying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, because we talked about controlling sort of the flexibility with that communication, that I can respond now versus later. But you can also choose who you're interacting with in a more explicit way, right? So you think about being in school or at your job, and you're anytime you're physically near other people, mm-hmm. and you're there, you're with them, and you're kind of with them, even if you have different personalities or different interests, and that can create conflict or just discomfort or a lack of pleasure. Versus in a lot of online communities, you can seek out like just people who are skeptical of tech or just people who like surfing. So there's also this curation of who you're interacting with in a way that kind of removes the complexity from life.
Yeah, there's that too. And you know, I in no way ever tried to imply that I think we should get rid of technology or texting or anything like that. I think my main mission is, how do we bring more awareness so that we realize it's even happening? I find that most of the time when I talk about these things, the reaction is like, oh, that's right, I never thought about it that way. Or, yeah, it's true. And so those are signs of people beginning to even realize that the behaviors they're acting and how it's impacting them. So I like to make it clear that I'm definitely not anti-tech. I'm pro-tech, if anything. It's just about how do we design the tech to be as human friendly as possible instead of just market friendly?
Well, we talked about texting a lot as an example. Can you give some other examples of places where maybe text is replacing interactions or changing the way that our interactions are occurring?
I mean, yeah, I think when we look at things like dating, the workplace, there are a lot of standard agreements as far as what someone is trying to communicate in gestures like not responding to a text or in posting something on social media before they respond to someone else. There's all these really awkward social interactions that are happening every day because the social media that most of us are using, we're on it all day, but it wasn't designed for us to be on all day. So it's very hard for us to go about our lives when, you know, you have to get back to someone, but you're on Instagram and you post something and they might take it personal that you didn't respond. There's like millions of these opportunities for people to feel left out, neglected, ignored. And sometimes it's intentional, sometimes it's not. But because the platforms are so poorly designed for mobile technology and for integrated internet, it's causing a lot of, I think it's so ironic how Facebook's personal mission is to help people connect. And I find that what they're absolutely great at is helping people disconnect.
You mentioned in there that Facebook in some ways is, or not just Facebook, but some other companies are maybe poorly designed. And I think you also mentioned in there that maybe it's a question of who they're designed for. Are they designed for humans or just for the market? Can you say a little bit more about that?
Oh yeah. So I actually did a mini documentary called Attention for Sale, where I elaborate how a lot of what the pressure is for the market and in the media right now is to just try to harvest eyeballs. And obviously this is not new. This is something that's very American and was introduced, I think, to its fullest extent with the television. And we're definitely trying to bring that business model onto the internet and to the mobile screens that we're using. And I think as a result, it is proven now, there's research coming in, which I'm very grateful for, that is talking about the collective attention span is shrinking. And so why this concerns me is that people can't really focus. They're having difficulty reading as much as they used to, even a year ago, 2 years ago. And I can't help but wonder what happens in a society where people can't focus. They can't sit down and, you know, read a few pages of a book. Like, what's going to happen when we're all addicted to all of this stimulation? And so I think that this is a result of catering to advertisers and B2B business models instead of coming up with more creative ways that we can use the internet to sell directly to consumers. One of the things that I look up to Steve Jobs about is he always made it very clear that the point of Apple was to create good products for the consumer, and that this was a simpler process than working with enterprise because the consumer gets to vote with their money if they like it or if they don't. But he also has this great clip where he says, you know, when it comes to the enterprise market, it's not that simple. And who you're designing the products for are not the people making the decisions. And so I think that's been amplified by a lot in the past 10 years since the new adoption of the app market and social media platforms. And I find it very strange that so many platforms are not trying harder to figure out how to get the people on this massive network to communicate with each other in a way that doesn't need ads to intrude it. It seems like they don't have faith in how much money people would be willing to spend to hear from the people who actually want to speak to the people who actually want to hear from them. It's very strange.
So do you think that companies like Facebook, or I guess Instagram is Facebook, but do you think that they should be diversifying away from the ad revenue business model, which, as you mentioned, can affect ultimately our attention?
Absolutely. I don't understand why the advertisers have to be catered to and put first, especially because who's actually bringing the value to these platforms are creators. They're people who are actually creating value, and they're the reason why people are on the platforms in the first place. And if you look at the way these business models are structured, the creators are treated the worst in the sense that they have to be the ones that jump and hop over the algorithms. They're the ones investing and changing their businesses over and over again to fit into these ad business models. And if I was working with a big social media company, I would ask, okay, if these creators are willing to work this hard when we're working against them, how much different would this be if we actually made life easier for them? And there are platforms in China, like Tencent, who have been diversifying their business model and has had amazing results, and not just using ads to make money, but by creating all these little market opportunities for the creators on their platforms and giving them opportunities to sell things to their audience.
Can you say more about what either Tencent looks like in that space, or what how it would look for you if you were envisioning, let's say again, a Facebook with more diverse kinds of revenue streams?
Well, the interesting thing about America is that we think that the more ads you put on a platform, the more you'll sell stuff. And what's interesting about Tencent is that they were clever enough to think about, hey, if we only showed 2 ads a day to our consumers, the value of that ad would probably increase by a lot. And so that's what they ended up experimenting with. If you only saw 1 ad a day on Instagram, the chances are you would give that way more attention, which would increase its market value. So that's just, again, we're talking about philosophy and approach. That's one of the creative ways that I think we can start thinking about how to use ads, how to integrate them in social media. And then on top of that, they have all these micro purchases available for the mobile phone. So here's another thing that's important to know about the Chinese market, is that they didn't necessarily go through the desktop phase as much as the Americans did. They kind of went straight to mobile as soon as the internet got big. And so they don't have a lot of the stigma and what I think is like the psychological block that we have when it comes to the difference between desktop and mobile internet. And I'm guessing, I think it's easy to, or fair to assume, that part of that initial adoption to just mobile makes them look at it differently. And maybe that's why they're thinking of it in a different way and are offering these micro purchases. So things like, if you're selling an ebook, you can sell not just a book, but a page, a sentence, a paragraph. They will let you create skins for your app. So if you're creative, say you're an artist and you have a huge following, you can design your own skin so that when you go into the app, you see the design of the artist. And that's something that can be purchased. Music thing, you know, video games, they have all these different bits of software that can be purchased, and they incentivize these creators to make this stuff because obviously they're getting a cut from that transaction. So it's very exciting to see.
I've been with you on this, like that advertising-based business models change incentive structures so that these companies are incentivized to keep our attention on these platforms as long as possible, even if it's bad, blah, blah, blah. But I'm not totally convinced that it's easy to unwind that now that we're used to getting things for free, right? We're not just getting the platforms for free, but we're used to getting content for free. So even something like switching over to a model where we have to pay for better content. I mean, this is right, like the problem with newspapers is people aren't willing to pay for even online access to the New York Times, which is supposed to be really high quality because everything else is free. But I think some of these ideas you've identified don't maybe run up against that as tightly. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I think your fear is the fear, right? And why a lot of these companies are not willing to take the risk. But I think that as a nation who cares about this economy, I think the bigger risk is in devaluing the importance of the exchange of goods and services for money. Once we start to elaborate this attention economy, then things get really tricky because we're not necessarily trading our money the way that we would be if we actually had things to buy, like what you're saying. And so, yeah, sure, we have news, but the quality of our news has, because it's free, the quality of it is completely shifted in the past 10 years. And that those kinds of things have huge economic and political effects. They can change who's in office, or they can have an impact on all types of, on the stock market. These are huge swings that have to deal with our everyday lives. So I agree, it's cool that we have a lot of free stuff, but at the end, on a political and social level, is it free at all? I mean, there's absolutely a cost. And this is America, so we should be using our money more than just our eyeballs.
No, I agree with you. I think it's so hard to unwind once you're used to getting something for free. You know, now that we have all this even inferior free content, it's just a hard pitch to make people go back to pay for newspapers.
I agree.
No, and we actually run into the same issue in the podcasting space. So I'd actually love your thoughts on this. Podcasting, it's relatively new. This is our second season. So I've been doing it for about a year now. And I'm getting to the point where I'm interested in not losing money on each episode, but maybe eventually earning some money from creating what I hope is high quality, interesting content. And when I talk to other more seasoned podcasters, it's kind of amazing that it feels to me like a black hole. I've talked to people who have had really successful podcasts. I mean, by that, I don't mean the Tim Ferriss show, but I mean your average pretty successful podcaster for 4 years who have sponsors even, and they're still making money on the CPM model where you're making, let's say, $15 for every 1,000 times someone listens to an episode of your show. And in many ways, that model doesn't make any sense for podcasting, right? You know, it's like you're gonna listen to someone talk for an hour. You're gonna develop this intimate bond with hearing them and their thoughts and their voice. And then you're gonna get paid whatever, you know, a fraction of a dollar per person. It just doesn't make any sense to me. But then when I think about the alternatives, like how do you convince people who are used to getting this kind of content for free that they should pay for it? I think that's just a really hard sell. And when I even think about putting up something like a Patreon page where people can donate to support the show, you know, the people who do that now, they incentivize it by saying like, donate $5 per episode and we'll send you like a newsletter and we'll send you this exclusive blah, blah, blah. But I'm like, the good content's the podcast. And like, that's what you should be paying for. But I feel like if I put up a Patreon page that was like, you're welcome for the podcast, just give me $5. It's kind of like no one would go for that, you know?
I love that you brought this up because this is the glorious mess that we are now in, because a lot of these creators who do come to these platforms, such as yourself, you're creating this valuable podcast. And again, you're bringing this tremendous value for free. And the thing about a lot of creators or even artists, the artist type, the people who are using Patreon, those people are usually not well versed in business, and that's fine. It's not something like, why should they know if they're an expert in music? Why should they know about business? But it's definitely created this big, what I think is like a jumble. It's a mess. I think it's too late to monetize content in this country. I do think there are exceptions. I think, you know, HBO is a perfect business model and an example. They were able to create a private content channel before the internet, right? And this is why they're still even alive today, because that's how viable that business model is, because they had such good quality content that it convinced people to buy. But I think if I were approaching the market, the last thing I would try to sell is content. And what's so interesting is that all this pressure is being put on creators like you, like I, to, we got to harvest all this attention. We got to, you know, gather all these eyeballs, which absolutely means that it changes the pressure of what the quality of the work is going to be. And also for what, like you said, a fraction of a dollar or this or that. I'm at a point where I think people need to enter the market and actually sell something that is going to sell. You have to sell something else. You can't, good, valuable content is too democratized at this point to sell directly. The only exception, I think, is if you have a super strong brand. If there's something about the brand that separates people on a social level that they are happy to buy, but again, still, they're not buying the content, they're buying that social stratification, that difference in wanting to be perceived a certain way. But the idea of buying content is just, that didn't even get developed in the millennial and many of the Gen X generations, just not there.
Well, I think too about, so it sounds like you're making the argument that selling content is a bad business idea. Don't do it. But when think about, you know, when I think about visiting, let's say Forbes.com or Entrepreneur.com or the New York Times, they say, you know, get rid of your ad blocker or pay money to visit our content. And I think one of the things I've realized over enough of those interactions is part of the problem really is that the content isn't well differentiated, that really Entrepreneur.com isn't telling me anything so unique that I feel like I have to get it from them. I feel like I can really get some other version of it from somewhere else. So I think that kind of goes in line with what you're saying about brand. Like there isn't, a singular, strong enough brand on many of these websites that it feels like I can really only get this there.
Exactly.
So we've talked about a couple of things so far on sort of the attention economy side. One, that many of these platforms were designed for desktop originally and then sort of ported over to mobile. And then two, some of the ways that you'd like to see these businesses expand their business models to focus less on attention. So we've touched on a couple things already. What are some of the other things you'd like to see businesses or these platforms do from their end, on the maybe on the design side, maybe on the business model side?
Yeah, so I think for the business model side, definitely integrating more opportunities to prioritize the creators on their platforms and not just catering to influencers, not just catering to the people who can sell ads, but people who can actually sell services and goods. And I think as far as how the design is, whenever you're building a social platform, it's really important that the designer and the designers are people who understand communication. And a lot of the current social media platforms are on now were designed by, you know, young teenage kids and who, you know, are kind of notoriously known for being socially awkward. So I always say the psychology of the designer will always leak into the design. So we should be incorporating people who are communication professionals in the room when we design platforms to communicate. We call it social media, but I find it to be very much the opposite. I call it market media because places like Instagram essentially are malls, you know, they're digital malls more than they are ways of effectively communicating with your friends and family members. So I think we have to just go back to the drawing board and remember what the fundamentals are, what the point of the technology is. If it's to have a conversation, then it should be designed that way.
Are there certain design changes you would expect to see if they implemented that suggestion? So this idea that people who design these platforms maybe weren't the most socially adept, let's say, or that maybe they weren't really designed for social connection. What do you think that platform would look like if people took that concern seriously?
I think it would look something like Snapchat. Snapchat is an exception when it comes to social platforms that are designed to communicate. It incorporates presence. There are multiple parts of the platform where you can be virtually in the room with someone. Like, you know, even Apple took the little typing bubble in the text messages. That didn't appear until Snapchat was also incorporated a typing bubble. And there are other things like they are more congruent with the ephemerality of nature. So the disappearing messages are a way to communicate without having this sort of permanent timestamp on everything you say. That's absolutely influenced what we say and how we say it, is having this like permanent thread of our words, and they just poof the messages away. They disappear. That's just like this conversation that we're recording this, so it's a little different, but a regular conversation sort of dissipates in the air. So that's what they were trying to simulate.
That's interesting. So I think that's, I've only thought of Snapchat sort of from a negative perspective around this, which we'll talk about in a second. But those are really interesting points, that both the presence is there in a different way than these other platforms and the ephemerality that they disappear. My understanding, though, is some have criticized Snapchat for having especially maybe addictive, persuasive design elements, this idea of like snap streaks that they're maybe harder to break away from. What's your read on that?
Well, I think that if we're talking about gamification metrics, Snapchat is the last person, like the last app to point fingers at, because what they don't have are crazy things like buttons and public comments, which I think are what people are really addicted to. Their gamification feature is based on two people needing to communicate, which is way different than what we see on Instagram or Twitter.
So this is all on the platform side, the changes that maybe a platform or a business could make to make maybe social interactions easier or better. What about on the consumer side? So do you feel like we as consumers need to adapt our relationship with these technologies or what?
Yeah, I think as consumers, and you know, I don't hold my breath about this, but I do think that the people who do have an understanding of what's going on when there isn't anything being quote unquote sold and a product is quote unquote free, is that it does come at a cost of, you know, your attention, your time, your productivity, possibly your relationships with, you know, people in your love life or professionally. And the people who do see these unfair trade-offs, I think, will start to seek more opportunities to either try to use less of it or use more better design technology. But, you know, we're not really consumers of Instagram or Twitter unless we're buying an ad.
To your point with the Apple example earlier, consumers will vote with their dollars on these platforms. We aren't voting with our dollars. So
no, we're voting with our inability to look away from stimulating content or stimulating visuals. It's exploiting our nature.
Have you ever been in a meeting where your team disagreed about the best course of action? Maybe you didn't know which message best resonates with your audience, or exactly who your customers are, or maybe which features they want you to build. Customer research from an impartial third party can offer the clarity you need. That's why PhD Insights offers Customer Research Delivered. Customer Research Delivered uses a five-step process to apply customer research to answer your pressing business problem. Within 4 weeks, they'll design, host, deploy, and analyze a quantitative study so you can make better decisions to keep your business growing. Learn more about Customer Research Delivered by visiting phd-insights.com. That's phd-insights.com.
So let's switch gears a little bit. When you and I first spoke in prep for this call, you had just given a talk about how millennials feel unaligned with their age. And I was like, like, what was that? You know, say that as a 34-year-old who feels unaligned with her age. Is that a thing that other people feel? can you unpack your thesis there?
Of course. Yeah, I love talking about this. So this came about because for two reasons. One is that I was working with corporations who wanted to market to millennials and were using these really teeny bopper marketing methods. And I was like, whoa, like you do realize millennials are, some of us are almost going to be 40 in a few years, you know?
So is this like the driver's ed video for teenagers where they rap and you're like, oh guys, you're not doing teenagehood, right?
Yeah, it was just, it was so off the pulse of what was actually going on. And I think in a lot of ways, many millennials, I think, can identify with feeling insulted by a lot of the marketing because it's already assuming that you're inferior or incapable of something. And then, so that was one part. And then the other part was that I was seeing all these memes, really funny memes that were describing weird sensations of time passing by really quickly. Or like one of the funny memes that I used in the presentation was that if you were born after the year 2000, you are permanently seven. And that was something that went viral and a lot of people resonated with that. And I was like, what's this about? Because I also identify with a lot of these feelings. And I was like, why is there such a weird perception of time for the millennial generation specifically?
And well, this is partly was interesting for me because I sort of assumed before you and I spoke that everybody felt like this when they entered adulthood, that everybody felt like, oh shit, I don't know what I'm doing. And I guess my parents didn't either. But from where you are, you feel like there's something that is actually unique about this time.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, and I say this, and I don't imply that only millennials feel this way, but I wanted to articulate why millennials specifically do, because we are, every generation has their own unique quirks. And I think what's so unique about our generation is that we grew up at the same time. Our development period was during the exact same time of the social technology development period. And so I think that had a huge impact on our perception of time, on the way we perceive human intimacy and connection. And so that's what I wanted to dive into.
So in this talk, I know you had a couple main theories about what drove this change. Can you walk through a couple of those?
Absolutely. So I broke it down into three causalities of why I believe so many millennials feel this way. The first is this complicated relationship between time, stimuli, and the clock. They have a relationship, but they're all separate pieces. And so I break down how each one plays a different role in warping time perception and how a lot of what we see on the calendar or on the clock, you know, numbers influence our psychology. They're not just numbers. They are symbols which influence our emotions and our expectations. So I do think something, the way we perceive time changed after we went from the all odd year of 1999 to the all even year of 2000. The way we process even numbers is different than the way we process odd numbers. So I talk about that. The second is the immature internet behavior. So a lot of us were, you know, we started using these like buttons and comments and expressing ourselves through texting. It started around the ages between 10 to 15, give or take. And the way that our economy grew is that we didn't have to necessarily grow out of a lot of these behaviors. The economy sort of grew into a lot of this remote behavior, internet gestures. And so it created an environment where we didn't really have to change a lot of those internet behaviors to get access to adult things. And so it's how many of us are still behaving as of right now.
So a 16-year-old in the 50s, they might have had a particular set of maybe linguistic patterns or social interactions that they maybe evolved out of as they became older. But because the internet sort of evolved along with us, and as you said, got brought into business, maybe our communication patterns didn't have to adapt.
Right. There was more pressure to change those adolescent behaviors to get adult things. Millennials didn't have to really change a lot of our adolescent behaviors to get access to adult things.
And can you back up and say a little bit more about the time stimuli business? So, I guess to be frank, when you say like 1999 has odd numbers and 2000 has even numbers, I have a little bit of an eye roll there, but I think there's probably more to it than that. Can you say a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there's research and a bunch of psychology behind this. And one of the examples I give in the talk is with price. So the reason why, you know, people price stuff at $4.99 instead of $5, for example, is because you will sell more units at $4.99, even if it's 1 cent different. And that's because the brain is not processing any of the, it's not registering any of the numbers after the four in the $4.99. So I think you can apply a lot of that same psychology to, especially considering the vulnerable ages we were and still comprehending what time is supposed to feel like. After 2000, I don't think people were perceiving time to accumulate year by year by year in the same way that they were during the 90s, it's not just that, it's the ages we were, and it was the amount of stimuli we had, the channels, the YouTube, the video games, all this stuff. And again, I think it created sort of like this digital blur where those years weren't accumulating again mathematically in our brains the same way I think they did for the other years. And created this like, oh, if you're born in 2007, there's no way you're older than, or if you're born in 2000, there's no way you're older than seven. So yeah, that's how I would elaborate on that.
Yeah. No, and I mean, is this sort of like, you know, we're sucked in and binge watching all this content, and then we literally do have a sense of time. We do sort of lose that sense of time passing.
Yeah, I mean, the more images, the more stimuli you have, the more you will perceive time as going by quicker. That's science.
And then you started talking about the third reason that millennials might feel particularly unaligned with their age.
Yes, and so that's the lack of rites of passage. And I explain how a lot of indigenous and traditional cultures usually have some sort of big deal ceremony or event that celebrates the child moving from one life stage to the next. And it's very clear internally and externally that their expectations will be changed, how they're going to be behaving, what they're expected to do. All those things are very clear that they have to make a change in their behaviors and their life. And, you know, they feel more prepared for the realities and the difficulties of life. Whereas with our culture, we don't necessarily have this huge, you know, we have things like getting a driver's license maybe, or like graduating, but there aren't many, it's not as popular in our culture to say, hey, like you are now a man or you are now a woman because you went through this process or, you know, whatever.
No, and I know that some people have even proposed that this might explain the surge in doing things like the Tough Mudder, is that people are, you know, or these really intense physical challenges, is that people are sort of self-imposing rites of passage where they feel like they've accomplished something big just so they can kind of have that human experience.
Exactly. Yep.
And I'm curious, so I think what you said there about the lack of rites of passage in American culture makes particular sense. I would argue that one of my criticisms of American culture is that there's really a lack of tradition broadly. Even pretty strong American holidays like Thanksgiving, people can do it a lot of different kinds of way. There isn't really this set script of how everybody's really consistently supposed to do the same thing, right? There's the American individual ideal of like, everybody can do anything they want and that's America. Mm-hmm. And I think there are consequences for that, that we lose maybe a sense of shared experience. So right. With that in mind, I'm wondering, and I don't even know if you know this, but do you find this to be the case in other cultures besides America? So, you know, some of the other things you mentioned, like the development of technology that corresponded with the developmental growth of our generation, like that would still be true somewhere like Europe or Asia, but that maybe some of these other factors, like the lack of rite of passage, might not be right. There.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there are a lot of variables involved. I think that depending on the blind technophilia of the country or the culture, that plays a huge role. And I think, again, the tradition factor, I think, is super important because it's about preserving things that have worked for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So I think it varies. I don't think it's one or the other.
So something else I think you had mentioned previously when we spoke was this idea too of, because tech is changing so quickly, we can no longer, as sort of the younger generation, depend on our prior generation or our parents for guidance in the same way that people could in the past. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So there's a cultural anthropologist named Margaret Mead who published a lot of work in the 60s. And one of her observations were that as the younger generation was adopting radio and television technology, she notice this difference between how information gets spread through generations. So normally we think of information being spread from the older to the young, and information being passed down. We still think of information being passed like that for the most part today. And then so she also observed that with the adoption of the television and with the radio, that what was happening in American culture is that the young actually had a lot of pressure to teach the old. And that if you were older and you couldn't adopt this new technology, if you didn't have the tech literacy, then you weren't going to be able to navigate the economy or the social circles, you know? And so I think a lot of that still applies to now, where a lot of us have to teach, you know, our parents or our grandparents how to text or use FaceTime or, you know, even use certain software like emails, because they need to know this information if they want to get a job or stay in touch with the people they care about. I think as far as language barriers go, these differences where the young have to teach the old make it so that the old can't really prepare us because they have to depend on the knowledge we have. So it ends up resulting in a society where a lot of people don't feel like they know how to adult because the society keeps changing so drastically every 10 to 5 years. They can't give us the same advice, the dating advice, the work advice, because it just doesn't apply.
No, I do remember the first time one of my parents said, after I had applied to a part-time job, like, why don't you go on down there and ask to see the person? And I'm like, that feels like a wildly inappropriate choice. Like that felt
right.
Like it wouldn't show, you know, gumption like they were thinking. It would feel like a, you know, inability to read boundaries. And
right, exactly.
Well, and one of the sort of blessings and challenges of technology is that it can change so quickly. And with that in mind, I'm wondering, do you think that this will continue, that the younger generation will never be able to learn from the older generation again? Or do you think that, you know, as we sort of plateau in maybe a technological leap, that might kind of level back out?
I don't see any signs of this slowing down. It seems like we're just moving so fast that I don't really see that many people having the conversation about how do we preserve this type of knowledge or things like that. So I hope we start thinking about it, but I wouldn't bet on it.
So for people who want to learn more about you, can you tell them where they can find you?
Yes. So I have an email list where if you sign up, you can immediately receive all the most popular interviews, podcasts, and videos that I've been featured on that surround this topic of digital anthropology. And I'm Alex Wolf on Instagram and Alex Wolf Co. on Twitter.
And where's the website where people can find you to get on your email list?
Oh, that will be helpful. It is alexwolf.co.
Great. And we'll put that in our show notes as well at innovationforallcast.com. And with that, I'd love to turn to our Think a Little Different round, which we ask all of our guests. What is something you've changed your mind about in the last few years?
I think I've changed my mind a lot about just how the market functions. So when I first got into business, you know, I obviously didn't know much. And so I think I'm seeing how much America, a lot of what we're buying is feelings more than products or actual goods. And so I think that has changed my mind a lot about how to approach business and how to actually offer value for people and what people are willing to spend their money on.
So this sort of harkens back to what you said earlier about having a strong brand. Is that sort of selling the feelings?
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't know how you could survive in this market without that. I mean, unless you're already well established, but I think you can't be a commodity in this market. We're out of that.
I think you have an especially unique worldview. Does that lead you to have any sort of odd or unusual habits?
Yeah, but I don't think it should be that odd. Like, I noticed that when I go to the park, I'm one of the few people who actually sit down and like do nothing. And a lot of the people at the park near my house are always like running or walking the dog. And it almost seems like as it's forbidden to just enjoy the park. Not to say they're not enjoying it, but that the park must give you some sort of output besides pure enjoyment. And so I think that theme is very apparent in my life in general, where I find that a lot of our culture, we don't really prioritize play. We like to watch stuff, which I think we like to be entertained, but play and enjoyment, I think, are a little bit different. And so I noticed that when I'm just trying to enjoy myself or just have playtime, people are kind of like, what's wrong with you? You know, why aren't you doing this or doing that? Or how can you, you know, why are you painting if you're not going to try to sell your paintings? It's like, sometimes you can just paint.
Is there a common practice that you think will change in the next decade?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of common practices that will change. I think our communications are going to change a lot, the way that we talk to each other.
Do you think it'll get sort of wound back a bit or?
No, I think it'll get worse.
Really?
Yeah.
So does that mean in 10 years, it's like the personal phone call is completely gone? It's just text or?
Yeah, I think we're going to try to obliterate presence as much as we can. There's no sign of it stopping. So,
what is a view that's widely held, maybe by your peers, that you just aren't totally convinced by? Like, are there other things that people in the technology anthropology space believe that you're like, eh, maybe not?
Oh yeah. The idea of logging off, that's like my biggest pet peeve, because it implies an illusion that I think is unhelpful when it comes to how to approach the future. A lot of people, their remedy to the social media issue is by using it less, by counting the time you're on it. And I think it's a helpful band-aid. It's not a cure. The point is to use internet products that don't interrupt your life and your happiness, but instead integrate seamlessly. And by thinking there's an offline, again, that's very destination-based thought that I think we're plagued with, because when we were first introduced to the internet, it was branded as a place to go. And it is no longer a place. It is just with us everywhere. And so it's time to start building technology that can work within that field.
So on Innovation for All, we like to explore this intersection between innovation, so business, technology, entrepreneurship, and social impact. So how does the way we structure these business models, as we've discussed today, affect how we interact with one another? Whose voices get to be heard in developing these technologies? What are technologies or businesses that can support groups that have been traditionally overlooked? Who are two people you think would be interesting for us to speak to on the podcast?
Any type of famous, or not famous, but well-respected environmentalist, because I think that it would be interesting to hear how the tech world is impacting the environment, both with physical pollution and virtual pollution. I would say Nathan Jurgensen, he's a sociologist at Snapchat, and he has a lot of interesting ideas specifically about the internet being omnipresent, sort of what I was just speaking about before. He has a lot of interesting ideas about the future of the photograph and the camera as a language.
Those are great suggestions. Thank you. Alex Wolf, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
Do you support having more diversity of ideas in business? I invite you to subscribe to Innovation for All on iTunes or your favorite podcasting platform. Thank you to our producer, Nia Taylor, our audio engineer, Dave Visaya, and Rachel Shea. who compiles our show notes. You can view show notes from this and every episode at innovationforallcast.com. All words, no numbers. And in case you didn't know, we're on social. Feel free to tweet us at InForAllPodcast, all words, no numbers, on your favorite social platform.